This is the Partnership Playbook, a podcast helping sales and marketing leaders secure high-value partnerships that finally unlock business growth and reclaim time. I'm your coach, Phil Hayes-Sinclair. Welcome to the show.
Well, everyone, today's guest is a true pioneer in global entertainment. Larry Namer began his career as a cable splicer in Manhattan before becoming the youngest GM of Valley Cable TV. Then he went on to found something that you will know by brand, E! Entertainment Television, turning a $2.5 million idea into a global cultural force. From launching networks in post-Soviet Russia and China to advertising on the future of interactive TV and now leading ventures that blend media, fintech, and Web3, Larry has spent five decades building systems at scale, partnerships that endure, and content that connects across borders. Larry, thank you for spending the time with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So Larry, let's go back to the beginning here, because we have your book to talk about. We have all of these ventures, which many will know some of the headline acts, but there's a lot happening below the surface here. So what is the Larry backstory?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in an area of Coney Island, which is while Brooklyn has gotten gentrified, where I grew up hasn't been gentrified yet, so it's still a hood. Parents were, immigrant stock, and their aspiration for their children was, get a civil service job and be able to get a pension and, and retire at 65. And, for whatever reason, I didn't follow that path. I was the first kid in the family to go to a university, and I graduated with a degree in economics, and I soon realized after graduating with that degree that there wasn't a heck of a lot of jobs for economists out there. So I took what I thought was going to be, just a temporary job, and so somebody I knew was in the Electrical Workers Union, and they said, we organized this thing. It's called cable TV. I'm not really sure what it is, but here's the guy that's the union guy there. Go tell him the union sent you, and they'll give you a job. So I did that, and they gave me a job as an assistant. I wasn't even the splicer. I was the assistant underground splicer. And, I got paid $90 a week. And my job every day was to go below the streets of New York and help put the wires together with the roaches and the rats and the gook and all of that stuff. But I quickly rose through the ranks there, much to their surprise. They would say to me, hey, kid, you're using equipment that usually takes people a year to learn, and you're using it in a week. And I'm like, well, I read the instruction booklet, it wasn't a lot of rocket science. And so I kind of went from the assistant splicer to the splicer. Then they made me a construction man, and then I was an installer, and then a serviceman. And then what happened was Time Incorporated, which at then Time was a magazine and printing company. Mm. They bought in, and they put in some of the Harvard and Yale's, into the company to run it. And, they soon realized that I could become a good translator, because here I am with an economics degree. I know how to read a balance sheet. But yet I understood what those guys do when they go under the streets every day. And so they finally encouraged me to leave the union and join management, which I did. So I think I was 25 years old, and I kind of rose very quickly. I was the director of operations for Manhattan Cable, which then was the largest cable system in the country. And I had 300 and something people reporting to me. And like I say, I was all of 25 years old, so you had to learn how to manage really quickly, against a lot of resentment, because I think everybody that worked for me then was older, and they couldn't understand who the kid who used to work in the sewers was now their boss. And so I did that as director of ops, and then kind of like right around 1980, all the big cities began to realize that cable TV was more than just good reception. And all the big cities in the U.S. wanted cable, but they had this caveat. They didn't want it to go on telephone poles, because in a big city, it's pretty unsightly. They all wanted it to go underground. Well, the only guy around that who knew how to build underground cable systems was me. So I got recruited to come out to Los Angeles to build a company called Valley Cable, which was then the first 61 channel two-way interactive cable system in the country. And you know, so they made me the offer I couldn't refuse. So I left New York and came out to California, and and then I had everything. Then finance reported to me, marketing reported to me, programming, and that's where I got interested in the programming side of the business, and which eventually led to E.
This sounds to me, having been a company builder myself, and I know you've done it many times, we can gloss over, I suppose, a lot of the rejection and the disbelief on the path to getting to the point where you raise the money, where people believe you that an entertainment network like what's been built is possible. Tell us more a little bit about that, because this is not a smooth path by any means, right?
No, not at all. So I was still at Valley Cable, and we had 61 channels, but there weren't 61 channels in existence. And, being a Brooklyn kid, out in L.A., all your friends and neighbors are going to parties and premieres, and, they're part of the Hollywood world. So I would call up the studios and say, hey, could you put me on the list? And they go, no, you're like the telephone company or the gas company. You're a utility, and you can't get on the list. So finally, I met somebody in marketing at one of the studios, and I said, listen, I don't understand. The most efficient marketing vehicle that you have is a movie trailer. I said, it's the best 2 minutes of the movie, usually. I said, but the only time I ever see a movie trailer is when I'm already in the movies. I said, it seems kind of backwards. Wouldn't you want me to see that when I'm in my house to make me want to go to the movies? And he said, yeah, but it's like too expensive for us to buy 2 minutes of TV time. I said, tell you what, you give me the trailers, I'll put them on TV, you put me on those lists. And he said, sure. And they did. They sent me the movie trailers. And I hired a kid, I think, for $3 an hour to edit it together into a reel. But when we did market surveys, we asked people, what's your favorite channel? They go, well, we love MTV. We love CNN. We love that trailer channel. And I'm going, wait a second. I get the best 2 minutes of a $50 million movie. Then movies are only 50. And people love it. And I kind of filed it in the back of my head. And then when the company that I work for, which is a Canadian company, they sold out. And they said, all right, Larry, we're going back to Toronto. When are you going to come? And I said, no. I said, I didn't go from New York to L.A. to go to Toronto. I said, I'm done with the cold. And so me and my friend Alan said, let's, we were kicking around ideas. We said, let's come up with something to keep us in L.A. Because he was an East Coaster, and he wanted to stay in L.A. also. And it's going, we looked at, said, cable TV is like an electronic newspaper. Mm-hmm. Going back, I said, CNN is the headline and ESPN is the sports and home shopping is kind of the classified ads. But the one missing ingredient, which just stood out to us, was the second most read section of any newspaper, which was the entertainment pages. So that's what we said. We're going to start the entertainment pages of the cable TV newspaper. And, we thought we were brilliant. We wrote a plan. And 3.5 years later, looking for money after over 100 rejections, including one where the guy that we pitched actually threw the business plan in my head, people said, listen, the idea is good, but people don't start TV networks. You got to be a big media company. You got to be, Time Warner. You got to be Fox. You got to be Disney. But Alan and I guess sometimes being a little dumb is a good thing, in that we just didn't believe them. So we just kept going. And finally, we met a guy on Wall Street who it was funny because when we went into his office, he had movie posters on the wall. And a young guy, and we're looking at him, and he goes, I really love this. I want to do it. And I'm going, great. Normally you need $60 to $100 million to start a TV network. And I say, could you make it more like the 100 so we could do all the things that we plan? And he goes, oh, no. He goes, I'm new at this job. I'm only allowed to sign for 2.5. And I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do with $2.5 million? I mean, minimum is 60. I got to buy the equipment and all of that stuff. And he goes, well, that's all I'm allowed to sign for. So Alan and I just looked at each other and said, you know what? After 3.5 years, nobody's given us $60 million. Let's take the 2.5 and assume we're smart enough to figure out what to do with it. And so we did that. We took the money. And I had a friend who was teaching radio, television, and film at the University of Texas in Austin. And I called him up and I said, you know, Brian, do you have any kids that need intern jobs for the summer? And he said, yeah, we had a lot of trouble placing kids this year. I said, send them all. Send me everyone you got. And so Brian, people don't realize, because he is a monster now. It's in 142 countries and arguably the biggest influence of pop culture in the world. But yeah, he started with $2.5 million, 11 employees, and 31 interns.
I find that extraordinary. You know, when you were estimating $60 to $100 billion to make that work, which was not in, you know, 2025 money.
Yeah.
That is in older money. Just tell me why you thought that amount of money was needed to get started. I mean, there's obviously equipment. There's a lot of hardware that needs to go into this to make it work. But what else made up that ask?
Well, I mean, first we evaluated all the other TV networks that started around that time, and they were all in that range. Right. Some of them even more. You know, whether you're programming 1 hour, you know, or 24 hours, and you're programming to one person or a million people, your cost of programming is still the same. Right. So, you know, you have to fill those hours up with programming and stuff, regardless of how many people. And while you're at the beginning, you don't have a lot of viewers, so you're not getting a lot of revenue. So basically everything you're spending is, you know, is an expense, and there's not a lot of revenue attached to it. But then also, you know, you need, unlike today where you can go out on the internet, then you had to buy satellite time. Right. And satellite time alone was in the millions of dollars. Very hard to get, even a few million dollars. And, you know, we found a discount one and we managed to get on that. But, you know, and then, like I say, you still have to program 24 hours a day, whether you're programming to one person or to 10 million people. So, you know, all that is expensive. And then just marketing to the cable operators. It was before consolidation. And, you know, now there's 4 or 5 cable companies in the U.S. that control 90-something percent of the market. But back then, there were 10,000 cable systems. Wow. So you literally had to hire people and have affiliate salespeople literally to go around cable system to cable system and convince them to sign contracts.
So being able to take this model with all of the manual labor that would come to it, because today – signing contracts, moving between providers, pretty straightforward, very different back then. How did you think about building a model that would be replicable, particularly when you were looking outside of the US, when, yes, LA was done, New York was done, but there are other countries asking you to come out to other places to make that as consistent as possible? How were you thinking about that at the time?
Yeah, well, I've always kind of been very much into understanding the technology. And I'm an unusual person in Hollywood because, A, I'm a creative, but I'm a creative with an economics degree, so I understand the underlying fundamentals of business. And I've always just felt, I said, you know, now there are several things that are going on. Hollywood, then, if you wanted to make any kind of visual entertainment back then, you had to come to Hollywood. Right. And you needed big sound stages and you needed very expensive equipment. When I first got involved, you had to spend $250,000 for a camera that's not as good as the camera on my iPhone. You know, that's where it is. So, but I said, you know, as technology keeps bringing down the cost of production, Hollywood becomes less and less of the place you have to go, but rather becomes kind of a mindset. It's a level of creativity. It's a level of a measure of quality, but it's not the geographic place that you have to go. So I said there are going to be other countries that are going to begin to start producing things that are very specific to their populations and the people who live there. So I became fascinated with the international markets, and that's why E! Is now 142 countries. Mm-hmm. And that was very deliberate. I just said, you need to be out. We had a subject matter that lends itself to global. I mean, people are interested in Hollywood stars and celebrities and stuff like that. Where a lot of networks didn't have that, you know, even the big companies, if you had CNN, who cared about the news in Washington if you lived in Nairobi? Or you couldn't care about the Weather Channel or, you know, any of those things. But yet celebrities and celebrity culture was global. And so we really made that very conscious decision to blow it out globally. I mean, in the first year, we were in 14 countries, which was unthinkable, unheard of it then. That was one. And then the other thing that always struck me as we moved from an analog world to a digital world, I said, and people used to hate when I say this, particularly the networks. I said, the days of, having set networks with linear television, those are going away. I mean, all you got to do is ask yourself a very simple question. It's, do you want to watch what NBC wants you to watch when they want you to watch it? Or do you want to watch what you want to watch it when you want to watch it on the device you want to watch it on? We all know the answer to the question. We could argue if it's a year away or 5 years away, whatever. We could argue about time frame, but we can't argue about inevitability. We started E-Online. We were the first celebrity thing to move to online. And, we did a lot of that. And then, in my post-E days, I've just really been, about creating the content that goes on any platform, on any device, as opposed to trying to have a network and convince you need to watch it tonight at 8 o'clock.
Larry, you were just mentioning before this idea of getting into, 14 plus countries in year one. What year was that?
We were by 1989, we were in 14 countries.
So something is just blowing my mind here. So if we think then about the leap from there into post-Soviet Russia and then into China, those two countries are very different to what we know in 2025.
Yeah.
So how did you think about the partners that you needed to get on the ground with there, given that you were bringing essentially a United States-based technology and mindset into two countries that are still trying to find their feet?
Yeah, sometimes you got to be very lucky, but it is, you got to be place yourself in the right places, So it's a combination of luck and timing, and just having good ideas. But I was still at E, and a lawyer, a friend had some clients that were merchant bankers, and the Soviet Union. You could tell it was still Soviet Union. You could tell that it was going to change quickly. You could see the changes coming. But the lawyer said, Larry, my clients have been proposed an entertainment related deal. Would you go there and tell me whether you think it's real? And I was like, wow, go to Russia. I never thought I would ever go there. I said, sure, I'll do that. And, so I went there, and the deal that they were looking at made no sense whatsoever. It was totally ridiculous. But I met the mayor of St. Petersburg then, a guy named Anatoly Sobchak. And he said, Larry, I want to start a music festival to raise money for the children's hospital and the orphanage. Would you help me start that music festival? And I'm like, I don't know music. And he goes, well, you got to know more than I do. I went, okay, that's probably true. So, we started this thing called the White Nights Festival, which in 6 days every year, we raised 100% of the budget for the hospital and the orphanage.
Amazing.
But, I did that. And then some friends were saying, hey, we want to start doing TV programming, and would you help us that? Because they had that communist mentality, which was, if you knew the right guy in the party, you'd do whatever you want whenever you feel like it. So I helped them, and we actually had, we started bringing soap operas there. We figured that they have enough trouble with food shortages and political unrest and stuff, and they work all day and go home every night, and they want something lighter and just kind of take their mind off their problem. So we started doing soap operas, and we had a very popular soap opera there. And but for me, I was still at E, so it was a hobby. And But, you know, probably the most telling story there was we were doing this music festival, and in order for me to get people to play, you know, and again, we didn't have money, so, you know, we had to guilt people into helping kids. You know, and the most famous story is, you know, David Bowie. And, you know, I'm going, David, I need you to play at this festival. And he goes, no, I'm not doing it. I'm going, why? He goes, I don't like Russian people. I don't like Russian food. I don't want to go to the bad weather. I'm trying not to drink. And, you know, every excuse in the world not to go. And, you know, finally he says, well, you know, for me to get on a plane and travel all that place to play another concert hall, it's just not interesting. I said, all right, David, here you go. There's a fort in St. Petersburg where all the czars are buried, the rulers of Russia for the last 500 years. I said, I'll build a stage over their graves and you could dance on the graves of the czars. And David went, yeah, right. Okay, sure. If you could do that, I'll play. So I went and told the mayor and, you know, Sobchak, and he goes, yeah, whatever you need, it's fine. Just go tell the vice mayor that I said to do whatever you need. Well, the vice mayor was a guy named Vladimir Putin. And so, you know, I work with Putin on that festival and, you know, and here I am helping the kids in the city that he was from. So we just had this very cordial relationship. We didn't talk politics or you know, doctrines or anything like that. We were just focused on making this festival successful. And, you know, and then when he ended up in the Kremlin, you know, surprise to all of us who knew him back in the day. He had a minister of communications and he realized that in order to build a consumer economy, you needed to have a media landscape that looked a little bit familiar to Western marketers. Mm-hmm. Said, you know, in order to move to a more capitalist thing, people are going to want to buy typically Western luxury goods, the Gucci's and the Prada's and all of that. And they're going to send Western marketers here, and we can't have the media landscape be totally unfamiliar to them. So he asked me to work with the Minister of Communications to write regulatory policy for running the media, which was not, again, not rocket science. It was like ads are 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 90 mm-hmm. seconds, and not whatever you feel like. Or if you feel like having a cup of tea, you just get up and walk away and go have your tea. So I did that for the Russians. And then some years later, the Chinese realized that they also needed to do media reform if they were going to build a consumer economy. And they loved the Russian model. And they went to the Russians. And the Russians said, no, 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 there's a guy in L.A. that did it. So I actually got called in by the Chinese to help them with that. And then they asked me to help teach young TV executives. And I'll put this with quotes around it. Teach young TV executives the process of creativity for profit, which I thought was just such a funny topic. I said, yeah, I got to do that. So I did that. And then they said, you know, why don't you start a little media company here so we could learn from you? And I went, well, you don't let Western media companies in. And they went, well, we don't let the ones we don't like. And I said, well, why are you going to be so kind to me? And they said, it's really simple. We have a fight with Rupert Murdoch. It's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. We have a fight with you. We go out for drinks. We scream and yell. But the next day, we're okay. They said, for now, we'd rather do it that way. So, that, you know, and that's how we got started in China. And but I think, you know, the one thing that really differentiates us is I didn't go in there. And a lot of this has to do with how your upbringing. I mean, you know, again, with my parents being very strict immigrant mentality. You learn to be very respectful when you're a guest in someone's house. And that's the way I approach these countries. I said, I'm a guest there. I'm not there to overthrow their government, to change their, you know, mentality and stuff. I'm there to make them laugh and hopefully go to sleep with a smile on their face that tomorrow will be better than today. And you know, we managed to do a lot of stuff there. You know, again, non-political that they normally wouldn't let Westerners do. And we still have a big company in Beijing and we do a lot there. But the difference between us and others, like people like Rupert Murdoch would go in and go, here's a show I do in Australia and we'll subtitle it in Mandarin for you and you can put it on TV. And the Chinese are going, listen, we're like four times bigger than you, America. Mm. We're really happy to be Chinese. And if you don't want to produce things in our language for our people, you're in the wrong place. So when we went in, we said we produce in Mandarin for Chinese people. And that was the big, big difference. And, you know, it turned out we were smart to do that because we're still there. You know, most American companies are gone from there, but we're still there. And just paid attention to the difference. But 80% of people all around the world, I think, are exactly the same. We all have the same human needs. We want to eat. We want to pay the rent. We want to educate our kids. And that, you know, 20% is based on where we grew up and how we grew up and stuff like that. But in China, we just paid attention to the differences in people. So like in the U.S., when we would do the news, like e-news, you know, it would be very salacious. It would be so Tom Cruise, tell us about that religion that you're part of. You know, in China, Chinese people weren't up to that yet. And they're like, no, what does Tom Cruise do on the weekend with his kids? You know, it was much softer and much gentler. And we really paid attention to that. We catered to that and had, you know, very popular shows. Still, we do a lot of stuff that's incredibly popular there. And a lot of stuff with new technology. We were really into immersive. Entertainment, things like immersive Van Gogh and stuff. And in China, you know, there's a huge difference that we don't really pay attention to in the West. You know, they have early retirement there. I mean, women are retiring at 55 and they had the one child policy for many years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a guy and a girl would have a kid and they would go to work. But yet now you now had two sets of grandparents who were retired. So you had six adults taking care of one kid, not just emotionally, but financially. Mm. And, you know, the aspiration was, you know, for the kid to get it, go to Harvard or, you know, go to Harvard to get into the NBA, one of the two. And so there was a disproportionate amount of money that went into the education of one kid. You don't really have that in many other places. So we would do a lot of educational stuff. We had scheduled, because of now the kind of the political situation between the U.S. and just about the rest of the world, you know, we put some stuff off. You know, anything that was really Western culture, we said, you know what, we'll wait till they settle the political differences and then we'll bring it in. But things like Shrek the Musical, the Harlem Globetrotters, Peppa Pig, anything that helps, that's for kids, does incredibly well, much better in China than it does anywhere else.
I can imagine. I'm sure you know the phenomenon of Bluey.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I think beyond our iron ore, our greatest export ever.
Yep. Yeah, Bluey. I mean, an amazing, you know, it's funny how so many Western things do incredibly well, sometimes even better in China than they do in their native countries. I mean, when I first got to China, the number one TV show, Western TV show, was Gossip Girl, you know, which was all about spoiled rich girls in New York. And it was the number one driver of fashion choices among women under 40.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Larry, you've in our research, we found a quote that you seem to repeat, which is around growth and capital. It goes something like, growth isn't just about capital, it's about control. Now, in what you've described, it feels like you have spent a lot of time observing the culture, the people in these other markets where you've gone to try and introduce your technology and your networks, which has been obviously very successful. As you think about balancing that aspect of control versus expansion and how money plays a role in that, like how do you balance the ledger on all of that, given there are such large markets you can move into and money isn't obviously infinite? How do you think about all of those factors?
Well, I mean, first we treat them all as separate entities. So when we look at China, we focus on China. So we're not looking, you know, where a lot of the big media companies around the world look at it, they look at it as a global picture and they go, how does this affect the global thing? We have China set up as a separate entity and Russia was a separate entity and U.S. is a separate entity. And we look at those, not just the numbers, but the philosophy and the way we operate. Right. Those countries, you know, very, very specific to where we are with it and stuff. And big companies have a hard time doing that. They just can't do it.
Interesting. And what do you think is next then for these businesses you've set up? I mean, we're hoping that the global order and behavior amongst leaders changes over the next, you know, number of years. But are you seeing these organizations you've set up sort of be more focused on their own territories, sort of ignoring what's going on because they have such large audiences to cater for?
Yeah, I mean, particularly in, you know, places like China. I mean, when I got involved in China, you know, if you would do a business plan for anything, China represented 1% of the global media market. Now China, you know, is the number one film market in the world. You can't ignore it. But we look at them as separate entities. We do things in China that are specifically for China. We also found that there are some amazing stories that have never been told that derive out of China that we can actually do here for global audiences that would have relevance. Like, we're working on a project now called Empress about the first and only woman ever to rule China. It's sort of Game of Thrones, but set in ancient China. You know, it's one of those big, expansive things. But we're doing it with American-born Chinese and Canadian-born Chinese. We're doing it in English. Because even the Chinese government, you know, we went to them and said, we want to do this thing about Empress Wu. Are you guys going to be okay with it? They were like, yeah, you know, so long ago. And she reigned over what we still consider one of the most prosperous times in Chinese history. And I said, okay, good. And they said, Larry, you're going to do this in English, right? And I went, no, how do I do it in English? She was Chinese. And they go, look, if you do the movie in Mandarin and subtitle it, maybe you'll get 1% of people that'll actually go see that movie. But if you do it in English, you have a chance that people might learn a little bit about Chinese history and Chinese culture. And we're okay with that. So we're doing, I mean, no Australians, because our accent is too different. But American-born Chinese, Canadian-born Chinese, we sound almost alike. And so we're doing that. It's a big project. It's like I say, it's a Game of Thrones, because Empress Wu, when she was 14, was taken into the palace as a concubine, and she rose through the ranks and became the first and only ruler to rule China, and then retired at 72. And, you know, and all the stories that happen in between. So, you know, we're looking at, you know, 8 episodes a season, 4 seasons, you know, big story.
That's extraordinary. I can't wait to see that. That sounds like something else. And I think for most women listening to this, it's about time we hear about a female leader doing something in the world. So I think that's going to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, it's actually interesting because for whatever reason, I'm now heavily, heavily involved in women-related empowerment programs. Yeah, when COVID came, I was spending so much time in China, but then when COVID came, the restrictions were so horrid. You know, they wanted you to stay in a Chinese hotel for 3 weeks. And I'm like, I'm not staying in a room and being fed under the door for 3 weeks. I'm not doing that. So I started doing stuff here in the U.S. And then a very good friend of mine, she was an actress named Jenny Lee Harrison. Jenny Lee was on Three's Company, and then she was on Dallas and but then she decided that Hollywood was not for her and she got out. But she came to me and said, Larry, you know, now that you have a little bit of time, can you help us start some media ventures that help empower women? So we jumped into the podcast world. So the first one that we did, we're still doing, doing incredibly well. It's just always amazed me. You go out to dinner with a few couples, and one woman says, I got to go to the restroom. And they all get up and go. And the guys are sitting there going, where are they for 15 minutes? What are they doing? What are they talking about there? But it's almost a metaphor for this underlying love that I think women have and respect that women have for each other. That us guys, we don't necessarily get. We'll talk to each other about business. We'll talk about sports. But we're not talking about our relationships and the latest in NARS Cosmetics and stuff like that. So we started this new podcast called Stall Talk. And we don't shoot it in the bathroom, of course, but it's it's reflective of those conversations that women tend to have when they're mm-hmm. and they talk to everybody. Yeah, they come out of the bathroom and they go, "Where were you?" They go, "Oh, I met this girl and she was showing me eyeliner," and you know,
that's
and
it.
We're like, okay, so that one's doing real good. We have women 4 different generations. And then you talk about whether it be news subjects or relationships or clothing or whatever they would normally talk about among each other. So we created this safe space. And you see while the women of different generations may have a different look on something, you feel that respect and love that they still have for each other. Mm. And then the second one we just started about a month ago, which is health, wellness, and spirituality for women 30 to 50. And we're working on a few. So our thing is, by the end of this year, we're going to have a block of like 4 or 5 podcast shows that really focus on women, particularly women under 50.
That's fantastic. I mean, it sounds to me like legacy for you and the ability to leave a footprint that matters is really important. Let me jump across to your book then with that in mind. We talked very briefly before we jumped on around the book called Off Script. On the website, it describes it as part memoir, part cookbook.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, because if I could spend 300 or 400 hours with you going through everything you just learned in Russia, let alone every other thing that you've done, it would be an expansive book of knowledge. So with this book, tell us a bit about that and what are we trying to get out of that? Because it feels like it would be chock full of lessons.
Yeah. Well, people have been after me to write the book for the longest time. And I've just resisted, you know, saying I'm not ready to write the last chapter, so I'm not writing a book. Mm-hmm. But then my daughter had a baby. So now I got a little grandkid and I go, you know what? I'm not sure I want to leave it to my daughter to explain me to my little grandbaby. So maybe I should write the book so he gets it straight from my mouth. But the other thing that really struck my real passion, even I'm good at the TV and the entertainment stuff, but my real passion is cooking. And I've been cooking since I'm 12 because, again, my parents both worked. And, mm-hmm. you know, you have to learn how to cook or eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for dinner every night. And in thinking about it, I realized you could pretty much divide my life up into 8 different segments. Maybe it's a form of ADD. We're not quite sure. But, you know, there's my growing up in Brooklyn years, my Manhattan cable years, my Valley cable years, my E years, my Russia years, my China years, back in the U.S. years. And so I said, you know what? I could write stories about each of that happened during each of those phases, but then I could combine them with the recipes that inspired me during those same times. So the book is somewhere between, a memoir and a cookbook. And it is so that the recipes actually do relate very much to the stories there. You know, probably the one that people get the biggest kick out of is, you know, how Alan and I first met O.J. Simpson there. And, you know, which is a strange story to begin with. But, you know, the first time we ever sat down for lunch with O.J., I remembered exactly what I ate, and I put the recipe for that in the book.
That's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And when you think about your next chapter, in terms of all the activities you've got going on now, what do you see the next number of years looking like for Larry Nanna?
Well, I'm doing a lot of stuff here in the U.S., like I told you about the podcast stuff, but I'm doing a lot of stuff because we know how to design TV series and that, not just from a creative point of view, but from a financial sustainability point of view. And for us, that's very important. Things that all have social impact components to them. So we finished up a series, Financial Wellness for Millennials, because kids don't learn a heck of a lot in school these days of real life skills. Doing another one called a Conscious Parenting about trying to be a parent in today's complex world, which is not easy, with all kinds of, from bullying to social media to gender ID issues. It's tough to be a parent today. And, then we're doing another one on cancel culture, which we think the pendulum has swung a little bit too far You know, we don't think you can cancel out history. I think you should learn from history, but you can't make believe it didn't happen. We have a nighttime talk show that is going to go on in the fall, which actually has a woman as a host, because in America, we don't have any women hosts on late night TV. And, you know, the shows to me are all the same. They're promotional. So Tom Cruise, tell me about your next movie. But we found this great gal out of the UK named Natasha Graziano, who 8 years ago was single mom, homeless on the streets of London. Cut to 8 years now, she's living in Bel Air and she's life coaching Will I Am and Steve Aoki and, you know, a half a dozen other major celebrities and stuff. But she's she's the number one motivational speaker for women under 40. And so we created this show around her, which will go on in the fall. Which again, it's more motivational, inspirational than it is promotional. So it's instead of tell me about your next movie, it's how do you feel about relationships and, you know, how do you deal with your kids and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So that's kind of the fun stuff that we're doing. And again, at this point, it's more of a matter of feeling good about yourself and the legacy you're leaving than the money that, I mean, you have to have financial success and everything in order to sustain it. I mean, we probably realize that, you know, as much as anybody, that, you know, reality is a life takeover. You know, you got to pay the rent and you got to buy food and you got to do all that stuff. But we're at the point where we don't have to worry that, you know, we can't take a risk on something, you know, that we think does have a social good component to it.
Yeah, I get that. Larry, when you think about all of the partners that you've worked with in the US, outside of the US, the way that all the plates that you've sort of put in the air are still spinning and working well.
Let me kill that.
Oh, good.
Go ahead.
Oh, good. When you think about all the partnerships that you've formed over the years to keep all the plates spinning, to keep the companies running, to have all these different points of view, when you think about a business partnership with another company to make something work, what's your philosophy around that?
Well, I mean, you have to be, you know, compatible on what your overall beliefs are and how companies should run and how you should treat employees and all of that. Because if you're not, then it doesn't work. Oh, I mean, it'll work short term, but it doesn't work long term. But you take, you know, in my case, Alan and I, you know, Alan Marufka and I started E! Together. And, you know, here we are 40 years later, and we're still partners in various different businesses. And it's because, excuse me, we basically believe in the same things, but our skills are complementary.
Right.
Like Alan loves the Hollywood life and going, being in the right restaurants and the right clubs and all of that. I'm the opposite. I'm the hermit. You know, I don't like doing that kind of stuff. And if he likes it, it's great. Let him do it. But you need both. You can't be this or you can't be that. You got to have both. So, you know, do your skills complement each other? And are you both trying to get to the same place? And like I say, for, you know, people are amazed that, you know, Alan and I still do partnership deals together and we're involved in some real estate deals and some media deals and stuff like that. And, you know, we're 40 years in, you know, and we still love each other. So it's very important that you pick people that at least you start out with saying, you know what, this could be a long lasting relationship. It's not just this time. I mean, in China, well, my partner there is a woman named Jean there. And what made that work for us is Jean had spent time going to school in the U.S. So even though she's born and raised in China and is very Chinese, she understands Western philosophy and Western business practices. Mm-hmm. So we can relate very much on those things. And, you know, so that's kind of it.
When you've had to think about winding up or bringing a partnership to a close for whatever reason, it feels to me like you are very level-headed, that there would be quite a significant amount of compassion you would exercise towards that partnership coming to an end, maybe because there could be a chance of you working with that person again in the future. Have you been in those circumstances before? I imagine the answer is yes.
Yeah, absolutely yes. And, you know, where sometimes just certain business things, I mean, look, I've been involved in a lot of businesses and some of those have failed. Whether it's our fault or not our fault, it doesn't really matter. It's, you know, economics could change, politics could change, technology could change and stuff. But I'm a great believer in don't burn bridges, because you never can tell when you got to go back, you know, and figure out a way to work together. So, you know, we have been very, very cautious on how we wind things up. And you try as much as you can to make sure the other person or company doesn't feel like they were used, that they feel they got a fair shake. And again, I learned very early on when I was in Manhattan Cable from the people at Time Inc., a guy named Nick Nicholas, who went on to become the chairman of Time Warner once the merger happened, you know, and he always said, Larry, you could be really, really firm, but make sure everybody knows that you're always going to be fair. And that's kind of been like my guiding principle is, you know, sometimes you need people to do extraordinary things, but at the end of the day, they have to realize that they were treated fairly.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, I totally get that. I totally get that. And so, Larry, before we get to a rapid fire round of questions, I just have one last one for you. It feels like the extraordinary amount of impact you've had has come from a number of underlying partnerships. If you were to sit in front of a set of executives and they were saying to you, you know, Larry, we just don't think we can grow the way that you've grown over time, and partnerships could be part of that, what do you think leaders today are missing about the potential to grow through partnerships right around the world?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people, I mean, a lot of it is ego. You know, it's like, I don't need anybody else's advice. We've always been, I mean, when I say we, me and, you know, whoever I choose to work with as a partner, we're very collaborative. I feel that, you know, I don't have all the answers, but I want to put myself in a position where I'm working with people that may have the skills and the answers that I don't have. So we welcome collaboration as opposed to going, no, we want to have it all and control it all and make all the money and stuff like that. And that's worked well. Everything that we're involved in, we're in a partnership with somebody. Even on TV projects and movie projects here, we always partner with other people that bring the skills that we know. It's kind of self-assessment. We know what we're good at and we know what we're not good at. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, accept that you're not going to be the greatest at everything. And if you could find people, or you really need to look for people who bring those things that you yourself don't necessarily have.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, Larry, let me ask you five quick questions to wrap this up.
Sure.
And thank you again for the time, because it's been quite extraordinary. I've learned an absolute huge amount, and I'm sure our audience will as well. Let's start with this one. Complete this sentence. Partnership is?
Essential for long-term success.
What content, and this is a question I ask everybody, but I think you'll have a very unique take on this. What content are you loving at the moment?
I'm a huge artificial intelligence fan. And I think when you get to things like education, I think when you combine artificial intelligence with holography, you have an unbelievable chance to level the field of education across the world by getting the best teachers in whatever subject, creating holographic images of them, combine them with AI. And literally, you know, you could have, I always use this thing, I could have Albert Einstein teach the theory of relativity to every kid on the planet in whatever language they speak. And you think of the implications of that on the world, they're unbelievable.
Larry, I'm a scientist by training. And when I was in doing my undergraduate degree, we were still receiving these very 4-inch thick textbooks to show us how to think about chemistry and biology and all those different sciences. And in the final year, they released a textbook with a CD-ROM that for the first time could show you what a heart actually looked like on a computer, and you could move it around and have a look at all the dimensions.
Yeah.
And I remember having my mind absolutely blown. That was 1999. And then we fast forward 2025, and what you can do in education is something else. And so I think the kids that are learning this stuff now are at such an advantage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's not just the kids, you know. We had these strikes here in Hollywood, so you had the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild both trying to fight it. And I spoke to folks over at the Writers Guild. Well, I spoke to both, but the Writers Guild actually listened to what I had to say. And I said, you know, let's train these writers to use AI as a tool instead of fearing it, because it's not going to go away. No matter how much you wish it will, it's not going to. And we trained a bunch of writers over 50. And writers over 50 in Hollywood are discriminated against. They don't get work. But once you learn how to prompt, I mean, these writers were like, Larry, this is amazing. What used to take us a week to do, we now do in an hour. And it's, you know, it's fabulous. I use it, you know, if you were to say to me, Larry, design a TV series about coffee cups or, you know, whatever the subject, you know, to do a simple scenario and some simple analysis would take me 5 days. Now it takes me 30 seconds and I spend an hour cleaning it up. And I said, you know what? I now in 1 hour do what used to take me 5 days. If I could create the scenario where I could still get paid the same amount for my finished work, why would I want to do 5 days work for what I could do in 1 hour now? I mean, it's literally that simple.
That's exactly right. I am completely with you. Tell me, question three, what's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
Oh, you know, worst piece of advice, follow your passion. I'm an anti-follow your passion person. I think most people confuse passions with hobbies. And, you know, they don't have the, they're not egoless enough to realize that sometimes you're going to have ideas that, you know, just aren't going to work. And they hold on to them, particularly entrepreneurs. They hold on to stuff so long and they basically waste time. The one thing we all have as human beings, we're here on a very limited amount of time on this planet. We could argue, you know, some of us will be 70, some of us will be 80, whatever. But time is our most valuable commodity. And if you have ideas that you hold on to because you're passionate about it, my advice to people always is find something you're good at, work your butt off and become great at it. And then that will become your passion. And then you're going to then have enough resources, financially and other, to be able to pursue those hobbies as much as you want. Like I, every day I cook, you know, when I don't do meditation or I don't go to therapy, when I get stressed out, I go in the kitchen and cook. And but I have the luxury to do that because I figured out how to make money doing the other stuff.
Amen. I was having this exact argument this time last week with a dear friend of mine, and I was very much singing that song. I totally get that. Question four, when you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Well, you know, I come up with small projects. Just it's kind of like, let's date before we get married to make sure we really want to do this thing together. And, you know, half the time you find that probably it's not going to work in the long term because you think of things in different ways and you have different ways of of managing people and stuff like that. So, you know, that's kind of it. I'm always date before you get married kind of.
I get that. And tell me, Larry, what's one thing you're grateful for today?
My health. The fact that, you know, people look at me and they go, Larry, why don't you retire? You know, and you can certainly do that. And I'm like, well, what would I do every day? I mean, I wake up and like read the newspaper, or I said, that's just not me. So, you know, I've got the health and the stamina to literally do the same things I've been doing literally for 50 years. I mean, I've just not slowed down because I love what I do.
Larry, for everybody, the book is called Off Script. Larry's background, we have touched on it at the highest level, and there is so much depth living below this. Larry, where can we send people to learn more about you, the activities you're doing in women's empowerment? What's the best resource to send them towards?
Well, you could. I'm a pretty good Google. You know, you just type my name into Google, and you'll come up with literally hundreds of things. And you know, since COVID, I become much more social and much more out. I used to be a little bit of a hermit, so mm-hmm. there's all kinds of interviews and things on online with me there. So,
well, I just want to say a huge thank you for making the time. It has been an incredible hour, and I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but thank you for making the time. We will link to everything down below, and I look forward to learning a lot more from you, because there is an immense amount that we can learn from the journey you've been on.
Great. Thank you so much.
Before you go, I have a quick question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility with the wrong partnerships? It's exhausting to pretend everything's fine while secretly worrying that you've made the wrong call. You see others thriving with the right connections, and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities that could really elevate your business. Well, the good news is that ends today, because you can download my free partner calculator that instantly assesses if a partner is an ideal fit for your business. It'll give you the clarity and the confidence and the edge you've been looking for to secure high-value partnerships that not only finally unlock business growth, but also help you reclaim your time. The link is in the show notes. And I'm really glad you're here. I'm Coach Phil Hayes Sinclair. I'll see you in the next episode.